This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. I'll be reading again from Is She Coming Too? Memoirs of a Lady Hunter, with illustrations by Wisconsin's own Jonathan Wilde. These are stories about biologist Frances Hammerstrom's hunting experiences throughout her life. I'll be reading the short prologue, where she writes that hunting, quote, is a long, fascinating road leading to moments of ecstasy, unquote. And I'll read the first chapter called A Date to Go Hunting, written about a date she had at age 15. Born in 1907, her stories in this book vary in time quite a bit as she became a hunter at a very early age. She devised ingenious ways as a very young girl to hide her shotgun and the animals she cared for in secret by planting poison ivy around the area where she kept them in outbuildings. She was adept at sneaking out of the house for many forays, climbing huge trees to hide in for the day, or go farther afield to explore. She was escaping her conservative, proper family, who would have disapproved strongly of all this, to say the least. She and her husband were a formidable team. If you haven't heard of Frederick and Fran Hammerstrom, here's a short introduction. They were born in the first decade of the 1900s, and for their entire careers were hardworking biologists here in Wisconsin, doing rigorous pioneering research on prairie chickens and sharp-tailed grouse in the Central Sands. And this at the same time as Fran's lifelong work studying raptors, especially marsh harriers, American kestrels, golden eagles, and bald eagles, as well as many other species of birds of prey. She and her husband, everyone called him Hammy, both took any and all opportunities to hunt during the fall and winter, and they often hunted with their mentor and professor, Aldo Leopold, who also wrote some great hunting stories in a Sound County almanac. Fran wrote many books about their lives and their studies. I highly recommend them all. I've read on this program from many of them, and they're all archived on the WDRT website for you to find. There are two books about them as well, one by Helen Cornelli, a close friend of theirs, called Mice in the Freezer, Owls on the Porch, The Lives of Naturalists Frederick and Frances Hammerstrom. Helen Cornelli's last name is spelled C-O-R-N-E-L-I. She was a professor of English at UW-Stevens Point. And a terrific book of recollections by their many fellow scientists, students, friends, and family called Hammerstrom Stories, edited by their daughter Elva Hammerstrom Paulson. These books are all available at your favorite used bookstore. Hammerstrom is spelled H-A-M-E-R-S-T-R-O-M. And do look at the Wisconsin Conservation Hall of Fame website, wchf.org, for detailed information about all of their inductees, and Hammerstrom's included. The finest women and men in conservation our state has produced are honored there. I'll be reading the prologue and then A Date to Go Hunting from Is She Coming Too? Bill Vogt, who wrote the wonderful book The Road to Survival, once asked, "Why do you like to hunt?" I paused. No one had ever posed such a question before. "Some people," I said, "get their ecstasy in music, and some through a glorious sunset. An unexpected fragrance may carry one way back to a turning point in one's childhood, or that acute suspense when a grouse is about to flush from a wintergreen patch. Touch for me is one of my strongest senses. Just the feel of the grass underfoot alerts me to promising coverts. For me, hunting is so much more than the high point of delight of any one sense. I use all five senses, and all the knowledge I have accumulated up to that time. And besides, I hunt with my man. For me, hunting is not symphony, not a painting, not to be defined. It's a long, fascinating road leading to moments of ecstasy. Some people are tone deaf and so miss glorious moments in music. Some are colorblind and so lose the emotional impact that great paintings bring to our being. Some people can never use all five senses at once as a skillful hunter does. Besides, there is an alertness, a type of concentration throughout a hunt that demands an openness to the total environment. My father, a hunter, always dreamed of having a son to hunt with him. He had four children, three boys and one daughter. His disappointment must have been rather sad. None of his sons wanted to go up into Maine to trail giant bucks with an Indian guide, nor to dash down to Cape Cod on the big flight day. The one person who passionately wanted to share his hunts was his slim, blonde daughter. I was afraid of my father, and I never had a conversation with him. By conversation, I mean an exchange of ideas. Perhaps it is a pity that he never detected that one of his four children had hunting in her blood. Once he had a bizarre opportunity to notice that one of his children was a crack shot and a potential hunter. He took Bertram and me to Nantasket Beach for pistol practice. I, his daughter, hit the bullseye over and over again. My father was an international criminologist with an awake police-type mentality, but the thought of a female who could really shoot and probably hunt was so foreign to him that he never even asked, "Where did you get the practice to shoot so well?" He just scolded Bertram for not shooting better. When my father was on his deathbed, my brothers realized that hunting had been one of the most important things in his life. One brother visited him in the hospital and did his best to bring up the subject of hunting. He asked, "Which is it that has the long tail, the pheasant or the quail?" And that's the end of the prologue. And now, a date to go hunting. George Glover III was a Harvard junior, and I was only 15. We were waltzing at a Boston party, but there didn't seem to be much to talk about. I tried the weather. "There'll be snow soon, and the ducks will have pulled out." George, who was very tall, looked over my head and mumbled, "You ought to come duck hunting with me next Saturday." "Yes, George, Saturday will be splendid." Keenly aware that the frilly pink dancing school dress that I had been forced to wear made me look hopelessly unlike a duck hunter, I added, "I'll wear pants and all that." George seemed to be having second thoughts. "Are you sure you want to come?" "Oh, I'm sure. I'll bring my crescent." "Crescent?" "My crescent is a 20-gauge double barrel. On a good flight day, I find that a 20 is all I need unless somebody..." I looked at George appraisingly. "Unless somebody keeps blasting away out of range." George missed my close scrutiny. His mind was on getting his father's gun. "Think I'll bring Dad's L.C. Smith 12. The old boy hardly ever uses it anymore." The old boy. George plainly had a more comfortable relationship with his father than I did mine. George chuckled. "You'll have to get up early. I'll pick you up at 3 so we can get to the Cape on time, right?" "Right." At this awkward moment, the music stopped. "But George..." He didn't listen. George hustled me to the nearest chair so he could get rid of me. A moment later, he wafted Leonora de Pierrefeu past in a slow foxtrot. She had an interesting way of leaning back and gazing, actually staring, into his eyes. Competition from Leonora was the least of my problems. I needed to get word to George to stay away from our house. It was urgent that we meet elsewhere. Boston dances tended to be rather formal. It was easy for a man to speak to a girl, but the men who didn't happen to be dancing clustered in a mass, known as the stag line. I never saw a girl walk right into that mass in the middle of the dance floor to speak to a man. Just then the orchestra struck up "Good Night, Ladies," the last dance. George was in the stag line. Blushing deeply but determined, I pushed my way through the crush of black tuxedos. "George!" He turned, startled at a feminine voice, where it certainly did not belong. "George, we must not meet at my parents' house. I'll meet you at the drugstore by the railroad station in Hyde Park." "Right," George nodded. "Drugstore? by the Hyde Park Railroad Station, remember, 3 a.m. Saturday. If I'd had more poise, I'd have smiled and added, rain or shine. Unfortunately, all I wanted was to get out of that stag line. My father took me home after the dance. Most girls are driven home by family chauffeurs, and some lucky ones are taken home by boys. My father drove up in one of our big locomobiles. He preferred locomobiles to Rolls Royces. He let me open the door and scramble into the seat next to him like a little girl, and we started for Milton, 12 miles away. Did you have a pleasant evening, Francis? Yes, thank you. Each time we were stopped by traffic, my father started this huge car up smoothly, 4 speeds ahead and then fine-tuned by adjusting the mixture by means of a collar on the steering column. He would have been much astonished to learn that I appreciated his skill, and furthermore that I was in a position to appreciate it because I had borrowed that very car without his permission on several recent occasions. I didn't dare borrow it to meet George Glover III by the drugstore because I'd get caught. I had plenty to worry about. My bicycle had a flat tire, so I must get away from my governess and either mend the tire with Neverleak or get a hold of a patching kit and patch it. Bicycling to that drugstore with a shotgun was no great problem. My father adjusted the mixing collar slightly. For a brief moment, I considered asking my brother Bertram for his corduroy pants and a brown jacket. My better judgment soon came to the fore. If he says no, where would you get pants and a jacket? Just take them. Shells? My father had a whole case of skeet loads. I wanted something with more punch. I'd have to look for fives. And then, because my daydreams mount with delighted anticipation, I want to take a few twos in case some geese come over. By this time, we had driven about 8 miles. My father interrupted my train of thought. I'm glad you had a pleasant evening. Here I was scheming to steal his shotgun shells, and he comes up with something like that. But the shells were for hunting. My father and I had found that these lively conversations were by far the most satisfactory. We didn't impinge upon each other's thoughts. So I startled him when I interrupted the purr of the locomobile's powerful motor to ask, "How has the duck flight been?" "Very poor so far." These 4 words supplied me with a wealth of information. Father is hunting ducks. He will notice if you borrow a gun. Furthermore, be careful about taking shells. And very interesting, the big flight of ducks from the north has not passed these waters yet. Now that I had assembled some much-needed information, my thoughts drifted to other matters, namely, that bewitching Leonora de Pierrefeu. I leaned my head way back and opened my eyes very wide, gaining an amazing sense of power over men. This pleasant reverie was interrupted by a bellow from my father. "Francis, are you feeling all right?" By Friday evening, my bicycle, gun, clothes, shells, and raincoat were carefully hidden behind the stables. Lazy autumnal days were behind us. The wind started roaring out of the north, and rain spat, rain that would slip into sleet and bring down the great flight of the season. Anybody with any duck sense would know that tomorrow morning would bring ducks, ducks, and more ducks. It would be the day, the big day. At dinner, my father asked Bertram, "What do you think of the weather?" Bertram answered politely, "It's been a pleasant autumn, hasn't it?" Bertram, my little brothers Vasmer and Putnam, my mother and Fräulein, my governess, were not aware that the big day was to be tomorrow. Only my father and I knew. 2 hearts beat as one. My father did not know that I could climb out of my second-story window. He knew that he was going to the Cape to shoot ducks, but he didn't know that his slender blonde daughter would be out there in a duck blind, too. When Fräulein suggested bedtime, I made no fuss. Rain beat against the leaded panes of my windows, and when Fräulein kissed me goodnight after having opened both windows wide, I felt frost in the air. Sleet by morning. This is it. At 2:30 a.m., both my father's locomobiles were still in the garage. This was just worry one. What if he spots me riding the bicycle ahead of him through the sleet? I pedaled fast, and his very distinctive headlights never loomed behind me. The streets of Hyde Park were deserted, just streetlights, no people, no nothing. Until I got to the drugstore, there were people there, night people such as I had never encountered before. They were pale and mostly old. There was an old man with a hauntingly aristocratic face, and there were some overblown women who laughed a lot. And all these people seemed to know each other, and most of them poked fun at me and my gun. It didn't matter. In 10 minutes, George would pull up in his Stutz Bearcat, and we would be on our way to the Cape to hunt ducks. 3:10. George must have been delayed. 4:00. Perhaps he was in an awful accident. George was somewhat moon-faced. He wore dark-rimmed glasses, and his ears were very close to his head. I had never thought of him as a person before. 4:26. George is probably dead, or maybe just dying. 5:10. George is not coming. 5:11. If I hurry, I can get back to bed. About 6:00, I'm still panting from pumping up the long hill to our house so fast. My bicycle is carefully left outdoors. A wet bicycle would look suspicious in the garage. My gun is hidden under the stables where I keep it. Bertram's wet trousers and jacket are hidden in the cook's room. We do not have a cook anymore. Sleet lashes the leaded panes of my bedroom windows. Oh, wild north wind, those ducks, ducks wheeling across the sky and then down over decoys, ducks. 7:00. Fräulein is gently shaking my shoulder. Your bath is ready. You were sleeping very soundly this morning. 8:00. Breakfast. 8:30. Music lesson. 9:30. French lesson, interrupted by a telephone call for me. This is George. Are you all right? All right? Why shouldn't I be? What happened to you this morning? Nothing. I knew you wouldn't want to go in such miserable weather. George? Yes, Francis? Goodbye. And that's the end of the first chapter of Is She Coming Too? Memoirs of a Lady Hunter. I hope you enjoy Fran's stories as much as I do. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders, and thank you so much for listening.